Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. This episode is brought to you by One Cause, creator of powerful peer-to-peer and online fundraising solutions, helping over 6,000 nonprofits make giving more social, mobile, and fun. Reinvent your supporter experience to drive deeper engagement, inspire giving, and motivate fundraising in a virtual world. To learn more about One Cause, visit them at www.onecause.com.
Hi, podcast listeners. It is a pleasure to be hosting the second installment of our collaboration with AFP Toronto. I'm delighted to have four guests on the podcast with me today. I'm going to ask Nicole, would you mind just introducing yourself? Tell us a little bit about the AFP Toronto chapter and then introduce the rest of our colleagues here with us today.
Sure. Thanks, Jason. Hi, everyone. I want to welcome you to the panel discussion today to talk about healthcare philanthropy in the midst of COVID-19 with a special focus on our hospital heroes. I'm Nicole McCann, Vice President of Philanthropy with William Osler Health System Foundation. Thanks to all of you for joining, and thank you to AFP's Toronto chapter for co-hosting this discussion today. I've been an AFP member for the last 15 years of my career, and it's always been a great resource for training, mentorship opportunities, and gaining new knowledge and skills. I think today's podcast is a great example of real-time and important information that AFP's Toronto chapter shares with its members. We're talking today again about healthcare philanthropy during COVID-19. All of us work for hospital foundations. Our hospitals are in the epicenter of COVID crisis in the province. Hospital foundations are providing an incredibly important function during this crisis, raising funds for equipment, yes, but I think in many cases, having to pivot and fundraise for other critical items like PPE and also providing other much needed support to their hospitals. It's my pleasure to introduce my fellow participants, and I'm going to turn it over to Amy Wilkinson to introduce yourself.
Thanks, Nicole. My name is Amy Wilkinson, and for the last 4 years, I've been the Senior Director of Community Giving and Analytics at UHN's Toronto General and Western Hospital Foundation. And I will pass it over to the other Amy on this panel, Amy McKinnon.
Hi, I'm Amy McKinnon. I'm the Executive Director of the Owen Sound Regional Hospital Foundation. It is part of a larger hospital system, Great Bruce Health Services, which is 6 hospitals and 5 foundations, and we all work together. I really appreciate that AFP Toronto reached out to me to give a perspective of what it's like to be at a rural community hospital during this crisis. And I will now pass it over to Sandra Hawken.
Hi, I'm Sandra Hawken, and I'm the president and CEO of the Holland Bloorview Kids Rehabilitation Hospital Foundation. We are Canada's largest pediatric hospital for kids with disabilities and medical complexities. Happy to be here today.
Thanks, Sandra. And again, I'm Nicole McCann. I'm the Vice President of Philanthropy with William Osler Health System. I've been with the team for about 3 years. We are one of the largest health systems in Canada, which includes Brampton Civic Hospital, Peel Memorial Centre for Integrated Health and Wellness, and Etobicoke General Hospital in North Toronto. And we serve about 1.3 million residents in our communities and surrounding regions. And I'm also excited to be here and look forward to our discussion. So let's just jump right in and start from the beginning. COVID hits. From a fundraising perspective, when did you know this was going to be a really big deal? And what were your first steps of action when you knew this was going to be a significant issue for our community, country, and our world? And I'll turn it over to Sandra to get us started.
Thanks, Nicole. You know, I, as the CEO at Home Bloorview Foundation, sit on the senior management team of our hospital. And there was meetings that were convened to happen twice daily about COVID-19 and our pre-planning before the state of emergency was declared in our province. And there was one meeting in particular that stood out most profoundly for me when one of my typically calm colleagues looked especially worried and deeply distressed about what was in store for the kids and families with disabilities that we serve, and a profound worry that there wouldn't be financial support for them as the crisis unfolded. And so we said, let us know what you need and we'll find the donors to get it. And then knew that it was essential to figure out how to mobilize our team offsite so that they could be at 100% capacity, redeployed where they needed to be so that we could be there when our hospital needed us the most.
I'll jump in. It's Amy Wilkinson. So we, we've been following the news, obviously, January and February as things, started to escalate around the world. But what sort of sticks out for me as sort of a moment in time where it became real for us as a foundation is we were holding a live broadcast at Toronto Western Hospital, Radiothon, on March 5th, the first week of March. And I remember confirming with hospital leadership in the days leading up to it that they were comfortable going ahead, that we were going to be, bringing people into the hospital and have, a couple hundred people streaming through during the course of the day. And they were fine with it. Our radio partner was fine with it. And then the day after the event, the news broke that the first case of COVID-19 had come through and been diagnosed in our emergency department. And our radio partner was on the phone to us right away. They were concerned about their staff and the supporters that they had driven into our hospital. Obviously, protocols had been already in place and there were no concerns in terms of risk to those in the hospital. But that I just remember thinking that was a turning point, like, okay, well, this is now we need to, really think about how this impacts our donors and our communities and even our staff at the foundation and working in the hospitals.
Yeah, I'll just jump in here as well. For us, it was very, very similar. It was the first week in March, and it became very clear that we wouldn't be able to hold our Holy Gala event on April 4th, which had about 900 attendees planned, and it would impact our revenue significantly. So our first fundraising came about as a mitigation strategy with sponsors and ticket purchasers in mid-March. And so we went from there. I think Peel Memorial was also one of the first in the province, among the first in the province to open their assessment center. And so that sort of, along with hand in hand with Osler, we sort of knew we had to pivot and pivot quickly. What about you, Amy McKinnon?
I think our experience was very similar as well. The hospital was preparing and, getting ready for an assessment center to be built outside. So we knew it was going to be serious and we knew at some point we'd be asked not to come into the hospital. We were busy preparing our spring newsletter and our spring direct mail, which as a small foundation, those are two major events for us. Luckily, although they were at print, they hadn't been stuffed in envelopes yet. So we were able to put inserts for COVID-19. Again, as a small foundation, we couldn't afford to scrap what was already printed to reprint. So we sort of had to utilize what we were already doing in a different manner.
How did you strike the right tone with your donors? I know for us and some other hospital foundations, they were out of the gate quickly, and then others decided sort of to tread a bit more carefully at first. What informed your decision around what strategy to take and the appetite of your donors and the community to support hospitals?
It's Amy Wilkinson again. I'll just jump in. For us, it was donors were reaching out to us. I mean, we were obviously behind the scenes, like Sandra mentioned, it was Nicole, apologies. We were looking ahead and knowing that some of our big, fundraising galas were going to be impacted and loss of revenue. So how are we going to make up for what we knew was going to be an impact on revenue? But while we sort of had our head down doing that, donors were stepping up. They wanted to give, they wanted to know what we needed. And at the same time, you know, our hospital partners were coming forward and saying, you know, here are the priorities, here's what we are going to need. So I wouldn't say that we knew we were going to go out there. I think we were cautious about how, you know, the tone that was right. We didn't want to be, you know, incite fear or concern. We wanted to make sure that they knew we were reacting and going after, that we were being responsive to the situation. So we did, our first sort of outreach was very much a health and wellness check-in on our donors to say that we're on it. This is what we're doing. We'll be in touch. We actually had a calling campaign that was scheduled to go out, a regular one for, you know, upgrades and renewals. And we, instead of making it an actual fundraising, we stripped the ask right out and went out with a check-in, a thank you, and a push to actually get people to provide their email addresses. That's, you know, we're constantly trying to build up our email file. And for us, being able to, you know, contact them and get them the most up-to-date information quickly and easily at low cost was really important to us. So that's what we sort of changed the strategy for that one sort of outreach.
So like Amy, we were in touch with our donors early on. From a stewardship perspective, we tend to be a high touch shop in terms of building relationships with our donors. And so they welcomed and expected us to be checking in on them and giving them an update from our perspective. And I think everyone's really hungry for information and happy to have friends in the healthcare world that could illuminate things for them. We were really sensitive about not opportunistic fundraising or doing anything that would appear to be inauthentically urgent. So we looked at what the hospital really needed and went out with that ask only. And at first, only to our closest friends, our board and our closest donors, sensitively keeping in mind those who were financially impacted by the economic strain that the province's shutdown had on so many businesses. And then we leveraged the philanthropic gifts from those closest to us as a match before we decided to go out more publicly. And what we found is that people wanted to help. They were grateful to know that there was something they could do, big or small, that would make a difference in a time of so much uncertainty.
Yeah, we were very similar approach. We knew people were drinking from the emotional fire hose and those first few days and weeks. And so our first work was more stewardship approach, specifically with our major donors, calling to check in, very soft touch. But we knew 80% of our care people receive in their lifetime will be in their community hospitals. And we also know that 100% of equipment is funded by our community. So we recognized that we needed to put a sharper focus like you. What were the urgent critical needs? And so we also recognized that this needed to be what it was, an unprecedented special request at an unprecedented time. And be authentic about it. And in short order, we sort of turned around and launched our Healthcare Heroes campaign, dropped a direct mail the last week of March, and created a concise 2-page major gift proposal outlining the urgent and critical needs of the hospital, including PPE and equipment. Amy McKinnon, what about One Sound? I know you touched on sort of pivoting the strategy that you had to make it work.
Yeah, and we were a bit slower. So each of the buck slips that were added to the newsletter and the spring mail didn't have an ask. We were really dependent on when Grey Bruce Health Services themselves as an organization said, yes, go out and you can fundraise for this for us. We had donors coming to us first. And what has myself and some of my sister foundations, we have found in the beginning, we were really a gift in kind heavy in the beginning, helping get donations of PPE from community organizations to the hospital, literally driving to businesses and bringing PPE in. We've also delivered 800 tarts that were donated by a local bakery, Dale's Baking, to help with staff morale. So we've really found we want to focus on cash because we need the cash to help pay for the field hospital that we had to build, which was unique for us. And the community wants to give stuff.
Well, as I mentioned, we, Osler Foundation did, we got a campaign out the door right away. We also knew we needed to meet donors where they are, and we also needed to move quickly. I think the other key thing was that we gave ourselves room to make mistakes. We knew that we had to take a bit of a risk, and we weren't aiming for perfection because we just didn't have time. And so even our stewardship, we weren't doing slick videos. They were on people's iPhones and selfies. It wasn't a time for us to do slick photography or production. And then I think the other part was integration and heavy reliance on digital strategy. So I think we went from 50 to 100 with our digital strategy just because that was the way we had to communicate with our donors.
I think there's a lot. This is Sandra. I think there's lots of ways that as a sector on the other side of this, we're going to come out better. I think that all of us are learning to up our digital game and to think carefully about authentic relationship building with donors and valuing innovation and culture among team. Many of us, that was a key part of our business before, but I think, you know, I know certainly at Home Blurview's team, there's been a number of innovations and process improvements that have had to happen because we were thrust into crisis, completely remote workforce with unprecedented fundraising demands in a very short period of time. And some of the ideas and the changes that have come forward would never have happened if it weren't for this. And it will make us a better organization on the other side and better fundraisers for it.
Absolutely. I think it's Nicole. And here at Osler, our team is having conversations about capturing, like, what are we doing new because of COVID, sort of the silver lining that we will continue to do. And, you know, we always said we have to do a better job of stewardship. We have to do a better job of calling all our donors. And one thing we did, because our community giving team had capacity because they weren't running our events, they picked up the phone and for all of our online donations, called every single donor, and they're doing that with the response from our direct donors as well. Those have responded and those haven't. So just, you know, that's one simple example of a tactic that we're going to move on and take it with us. And it's allowed them to have the practice and gain the confidence in being able to continue to do that going forward.
Similarly, I would say at Toronto General and Western Hospitals, where we are known for being a major gift shop, and we have, you know, traditional large galas, stewardship events, very in-person focused types of things. And I think, you know, the last couple of years on the community giving team, we've been focused on building up our digital technology and platforms. And I think this has been a great proof point about the fact that our donors are engaging with us in this method, but also they are able to, so they're engaging with us, but they also, that there's impact and we're able to raise funds this way. So it's been a really positive experience in that way, as well as engaging multiple areas from major gifts to events to stewardship in our digital efforts in a way that they hadn't been before.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, this is Amy McKinnon. My perspective is so different because I'm like 3 full-time staff. So we've never had sort of the opportunity to make slick videos. So it's been fun sort of going outside with our iPhone and talking and filming when, you know, the first responder rallies come around the hospital and taking, you know, just some candid photos of the staff. So it's been fun sort of experimenting with that sort of stuff on social and through email lists. We've been just trying. And I think it was you, Nicole, who said, you know, we're just giving ourselves room to make mistakes and to try new things. And it's been really great and an experiment that way.
Great.
As I'm listening to all of you talk, you're using language that would suggest to me that you're actually enjoying your job more than maybe you were 90 days ago. I mean, Amy, you just used the word fun. I don't know that I hear fundraisers using the word fun as often. And I have a different fundraiser too on this podcast every week. So are you actually enjoying your work more?
It's enjoying it in a different way. We're connecting with the frontline staff differently, and not just the physicians and the nurses, but the environmental service people. They have realized that the foundation is helping facilitate some of the, 3D face shields that are being made, and the sewing groups who are helping repair gowns, something that maybe the larger foundations aren't as involved in. So they know what we're doing, which is always great to connect with the staff.
I think too, from one of my colleagues said the other day, being in hospital fundraising, it's not often that we do crisis fundraising. It's not, like the situation in Australia last year with the fires or, earthquake relief. And so to have that experience, I would say it's been, energizing, exhausting, fun at times. And, I think about my team and how, even though we're all working remotely, I would say we're more connected and closer than we've ever been in through this.
It's Sandra at Home Blur View, and I've been pulling 15-hour plus days, never been more exhausted or worked harder, but also never loved my job more. So I have such a deep sense of gratitude because, while we're all living in this time with, lots of uncertainty and an inundation of fear-mongering news and more questions than answers, I get to spend my day every day thinking about how to help and being attached to an organization that's doing great work for especially vulnerable populations. So it's very perspective building and gratitude is how I feel. And there's some fun too. I mean, we had a baby shower 2 days ago on Zoom for one of my staff that was ridiculously hilarious. And all of the dogs and children and everyone participated in a way that we wouldn't on a typical day or week.
Absolutely. I think there's nothing like a crisis to give you purpose. And most of us that work in this the charitable sector and healthcare philanthropy specifically do it because of the meaning. And a crisis like COVID is like none other. And it doesn't just touch our geographic area. It's a global thing. And I think from a major strategy, we have the benefit that the media, we're living at 24/7 and the media is telling our story. And so we don't have to build a complicated case for support. The community already knows what that is. But like Sandra, we have never, our pace and volume and length of days has never been longer. But I think the fact that we know we're making an impact and touching our community is energizing us and pulling us together.
So perhaps part of the reason that you all feel the silver lining that you're all describing is because healthcare is so close to this current sort of reality, this current crisis. But are there insights if you're an organization that's not close to the issue, are there insights that you all could be drawing from this experience that you would share, say, to the human services administrator or the person who's working at a museum or something who doesn't get to sort of attach themselves so closely to the current situation? What sort of insights would you offer them?
Well, at Hall and Blurview, we're sort of in a unique situation in that while we are a hospital that, is part of the network and a part of what is happening right now, we work with a specific population of kids with disabilities. And we are primarily an ambulatory hospital with a small number of less than 100 inpatient beds, but with a provincial impact. And so a lot of what we offer at Hall and Blurview is like a community agency. We do a lot of, we have swimming lessons and summer camps and direct financial support for families. And it's actually those things that we're focusing more on from a fundraising perspective because we don't want to compete with our acute care hospital partners in our geography. And the way that we're making it relevant is drawing the direct personal connection four people. So, you know, one of the things that struck me most was a family that we work with, a patient family at Holland Bloor View, who said, "This is my life. This is what it's like to be a person with a disability all the time, in terms of feeling isolated and disconnected from the community, in terms of having to Lysol every surface so my child doesn't catch a cold and end up on a ventilator for a year." And, you know, having that insight into what their reality has been like has been even more important for us in our conversations than the generalized healthcare platform. So I think it's finding what's relevant. And I think every not-for-profit has a way that they're relevant. If your arts, you know, all of us are passing the time consuming arts online or in print, and social services have a key role to play as everyone who is marginalized is suffering at a disproportionate rate.
Yeah, I agree. We can't discount the reality is that we're in a crisis, and the first thing is hospital communities have never been more relevant, and people aren't going to need them more than they need them now and today. And then the second is the socioeconomic impact. And so those vulnerable sectors like shelters and food banks are going to play an important role. I guess what I would say for those like the arts charities, just like Sandra, I would echo, make yourself relevant, innovative, and collaborative, and use this time. And I do think people are at home and they're a captive audience. So figure out a way digitally to engage them.
I think collaboration is key, what Nicole just mentioned. And one of the things that I was so grateful to see happen in the hospital sector, because we are, you know, literally and figuratively in it together in this unprecedented times, is another unprecedented thing that happened is that the whole sector has come together to fundraise together for the first time. A group of hospitals, including Amy's, started something called the Frontline Fund, where over 100 hospitals, all of us included, are benefiting from a pan-Canadian fundraising effort seeded by a number of significant donors, where we're all sharing in a fundraising message to help frontline heroes. And that's, you know, that mobilized very quickly and very collaboratively. And that is not something that could have ever happened under other conditions.
As a hospital that's excluded from being able to get funds from that, it has been interesting from the sidelines to see how all the hospitals came together, and to also wonder why we weren't included in that group. Why did the rural hospitals get excluded? We all have a relevant place in healthcare. So it was a bit curious for us.
There are a number of rural hospitals included, Amy. I am sure that if you raised your hand that you would be included in the group of organizers that put it together. We were an unexpected match as a pediatric hospital focusing on disability, and we're welcomed in. So I would imagine the critical role that you play would be just as, if not more, important.
Yeah, I would reach out. The parent organization that's helped binding the hospitals together is Canada Helps. And so certainly reach out and ask a question. I do think one of the criteria was bed size, but I agree. I think that it doesn't hurt to reach out and see if you can't be included, because I know some other rural hospitals are included.
Are you all experiencing sort of a heightened level of confidence, maybe a boldness that maybe you had not experienced before?
I think it's hard to be a fundraiser and not be a certain degree of bold. But I would say that one of the things that's been especially fine-tuned for us during this period is actually the opposite. Our commitment to listening hard to our donors and understanding what is driving them to consider giving when their stock portfolio may have plummeted, and really ensuring that the ask isn't necessarily aggressive, but is so finally aligned with what is going to resonate with them emotionally. And I know we've had the best April ever fundraising as a result, and in part because of the crisis, but in part because we've been listening really hard to what our donors want and need and giving it to them.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that we are competitive and we are bold, and we have to be in the charitable sector. But at the same time, at the root, we're Canadian. And I think we all try to play nice in the sandbox, but we have to meet our donors where they are. And I think we are also humble. So as much as we are leveraging the opportunity that COVID has given hospitals during this time, we are humble and innately aware that although we have a strong case for support, we do have revenue impact. And there are organizations we have to mitigate, and we have looked at our budget. We had to cancel our events, which is this huge part of our we're lucky we have a diverse fundraising portfolio, but nonetheless, it is a significant part of our budget that we know we're going to have to mitigate. And so we're grateful for the response from the community, but we are certainly humble, and I'm bracing myself for what could be a dry summer.
I also think, I think there is a certain amount of boldness, but I think we also have to be absolutely authentic and avoid the opportunistic approach. I mean, in our case, gathering what our priorities are from our hospital partners. I mean, research is a huge one. We've had to redeploy almost all our researchers, and they are all now focused on COVID-19. We're the largest research hospital in Canada. So it's a huge amount of resources, both human and financial, that we're having to follow up with donors who may have funded certain priorities. And if they aren't moving forward, how do we make sure that they're aware? And then how do we fund the new priorities that have come up? So although we're bold, we're still accountable to our donors. So money that we're raising, and we're fortunate in that regard that we can actually raise, direct it to where they intended it to be, whether it be frontline support or PPE, research, patient care, all in light of COVID, that, we can fundraise, but we have to actually be able to report back to our donors and say that this is where your money went.
Yeah. I would say too, something that's really surprised me during the COVID crisis is that obviously we started with our current donors who have been very generous and above and beyond their annual commitments or their pledge payments are making gifts specific to COVID. But the other surprising thing for us is the doors we haven't been able to open that are now opening. So our acquisition, the response to our direct mail or the major gift proposal doors that we couldn't get open before. And we are seeing a huge opportunity with that segment of our donor base that we haven't seen before. Our gift processing team is commenting on how many new donor prospects they have to actually set up because we're acquiring new donors, which is a surprisingly good thing. I don't know, what are others seeing?
We're seeing the same in terms of new donors and being able to engage others that hadn't quite yet found their way to engage in our donor community. Now is the moment that is making sense for them. But also donors who have been giving for a long time, giving in different ways and unexpected ways. So lots of really great surprises. And probably the biggest surprise for me is that so often in the public conversation and in the fundraising conversation, people with disabilities are left out. And that just hasn't been the case during this. There is an understanding from the community that, that people with disabilities and the kids that we work with are some of the most immunocompromised and medically fragile, and keeping them safe is essential. And it's been, really heartwarming to see people come forward that that are brand new to us, who get that fact and want to be part of it and part of inclusion.
Absolutely.
Before, Nicole, I know you had some questions you were going to sort of wrap everybody up with, but I'm curious, as we've got five more installments of this conversation with the rest of the members in your chapter, what are some of the questions that you all are curious to hear from the other members of the Toronto chapter?
This is Amy Wilkinson. My thing is, How does this play out? How do we keep, we've been talking about, you know, the new opportunities and new donors we brought on board, and they're coming on obviously, or primarily to support COVID efforts and the impact of COVID. So how do we keep them engaged if, obviously, I know that there, you know, there's likely to be a second wave and a third wave, we're being told, and we don't know how, you know, the length of this, but how do we get a second gift, or how do we even get our existing donors to give again if this continues on for some time? So that's one thing we're sort of grappling with. And then how do we go back? You know, we still have other priorities from, other program areas that are not, you know, maybe not affected directly by COVID, but have been put on hold and on pause. And how do we get back there? When, you know, given the financial crisis and everything else that goes on to it. So I, you know, how is this going to play out, and what's next, and how do we even prepare for that?
Yeah, I think I would have similar, like, what does the next 12 to 18 months look like? And then how do we bridge ourselves from COVID back to, and I hesitate to say business as usual, because I don't think it will ever be business as usual again. Our business will be different, but what is the bridge, and how do we bridge ourselves back to some of the regular annual business plan objectives that we have?
And also importantly, what role does the not-for-profit sector and the fundraising sector play in a world post-COVID with a financial system that's going to be rebuilding, lots of people struggling, and a government that will be stretched in ways it never has been before? What's our role, and how do we stay relevant and keep top of mind while being sensitive to the fact that there's going to be less money to give?
Absolutely. And when I said we're, you know, humble, embracing ourselves, I think that's the second wave, is that the, people that are a bit protected economically are the ones that are able to give. And there's certain segments of the economy that are benefiting while others are challenging. And that's where we can tap into. But I do think the second wave will be the socioeconomic. So those small businesses that are currently in pledges to our organization that might not be able to fulfill their commitments. I do think we have to, that will be a challenging time for us to navigate. And you're right, what role do we play in that? Great. Should we move to our last question?
Did we haven't heard from Amy McKinnon since early. We haven't heard from you, Amy, in a while.
I'm listening, and it's really interesting to learn from everybody. And something that's really curious for me when we pivot from COVID-19 is, here's a real life example. We just celebrated finishing a huge MRI campaign for our community. We raised $4.7 million in 2 years. It's a big accomplishment for us, and we need to celebrate that. And how do we celebrate that now? So it's going to be interesting how we continue not only supporting our institutions for their COVID needs, but also their other needs that they still have to move as a healthcare system forward.
Yeah, I think it's going to take creativity and timing. And maybe you do it, but differently than you would have done it, because I think we have to, as I said before, meet our donors where they are, and we can't be tone deaf to what the environment that we're fundraising in. So I think we're all going to have to revisit what we were going to do, and might not necessarily do it or do it the same way. I also think, one final comment or thought is that this is unprecedented times, and this pandemic, I think, will have a generational impact. And I think that the need for equipment and the need for the services that our organizations and healthcare organizations and hospitals provide will be a strong case that we can embed and tweak the strategies going forward and ride this wave for the near future, but also the longer term future. Do others kind of think the same?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So I think this has been a great conversation. One last question, and it's a rapid fire one. what is one word you would use to describe fundraising at your hospital at this time? And I'll start with Sandra.
I'm going to cheat and do a hyphenated word, values-based.
Perfect. Amy Wilkinson?
I honestly don't, it's all the words. I think, Sandra, you said it. I'm exhausted, but in a great way. I don't want to sound negative, but like exhausting, but it's great at the same time. Energizing. I'll go with energizing. How about that one?
There you go.
Amy Wilkinson.
That was Amy Wilkinson.
Amy McKinnon.
Yeah. I think there's been lots of words said during our discussion today, like bold and innovation. And certainly I think energizing, and we're just adapting every day.
Yeah. Nicole, I can't think of a better way to sort of wrap this up. I think that was a very great way to do that, because I think, and that's one of the joys that I get of hosting this podcast, is I get to listen to everyone's language. And I hope that for your chapter, as they're listening to this discussion, that they will have heard a very upbeat and yes, we're all exhausted and we're all being tested and tried in ways that we've never been tested before. But it's also somewhat of an exhilarating and energizing, as Amy said, an energizing experience. Nicole, if someone is listening today and they want to know how to reach out to the AFP chapter in Toronto, how would you suggest that they do that?
Well, fellow AFP members can stay in touch and share their resources on AFP Connect. There's different forums available where members can discuss their personal and professional challenges, key learnings, including forums on mental health and wellness, and how to pivot business operations in light of COVID-19. I do want to thank you so much for co-hosting this today. And to everyone for joining for this very important discussion. I think there were so many great points raised, both educational and inspiring, to chat with all of you. Before we sign off, I just want to mention that AFP Greater Toronto Chapter members can also join in the upcoming Member Town Hall on April 30th. Details on the AFP Toronto website at www.afptoronto.org. It's a chance for chapter members to ask questions about fundraising from home. Opportunity to hear our chapter executive director, Penny Connors, on new programs and initiatives, and an opportunity to swap learnings and share stories with other members. Thanks to everyone. Stay safe and be well.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.